Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Before we get to the interview for this episode, I'd like to talk for just a minute. I've been away the past few weeks. That's because my mom, Virginia Tomlinson, died at the end of January in her room in a nursing home in Springfield, Georgia. My mom lived 85 years, and to my knowledge, she set foot in only four states her whole life, Georgia, Florida, and the Carolinas. When I tell her I was going somewhere far away, the Super Bowl maybe, or Las Vegas, she'd think about it a minute, and then she'd say, you know, I wouldn't cross the street to see that. The things that mattered to her were close to home. The roses she grew in her backyard. The romance novels she read by the bagful. Most of all, her family and friends. The times she enjoyed most were the times when her house was full of the people she loved. The South meant a lot to her. Not the Confederate South or the hillbilly South you sometimes see on TV, but what I think of is the true South, where no one's a stranger and we all swap stories on long summer nights. The people at the nursing home took amazing care of her, and she loved them. But she had one complaint. They never could season her food enough. She kept salt and red pepper flakes stashed in a dresser drawer to doll up her vegetable soup. Maybe, I've come to believe, that's one way to think of the South. Like the rest of the country, but with better seasoning. Part of the reason I wanted to do this podcast was to capture some of the feel of those Southern nights, to let people have a little room to breathe and tell a story or two. My mom got to listen to the first few episodes through headphones hooked up to a laptop in her room up there at the nursing home. She said she liked them, but then again, she would. I'm glad she got to hear this thing get started. I did it, as I do most of the work I do, thinking about her. Now to today's episode. My guest is Andrea Kirby. And if you don't recognize that name, you might recognize her voice, especially if you're a sports fan of a certain age. She was one of the first women to broadcast sports to a national audience when she worked on ABC's Wide World of Sports and College Football Scoreboard back in the 70s. From there, she started a new career teaching athletes and coaches to be more comfortable in front of the camera. She came to the studio full of stories about her life in sports. Here's my conversation with Andrea Kirby. So Andrea, your son, Gentry, who's a producer director for ESPN Films, the first thing he said when I asked him about you is that I have to ask you about Bear Bryant. No. And if you have a Bear Bryant story. So I assume there is one.
Oh, there is one. It's deep in my history, but I don't mind making that leap. I was at the University of Alabama, and I was in radio and television in the communications department. We could make our own assignments, pick things we wanted to do. And for one of my exams, I was going to do play-by-play in baseball. So I was out practicing with the Alabama baseball team. Bear Bryant was sitting up in the stands. I think his son was playing baseball for Alabama at the time. So as soon as I got a chance, I ran over and introduced myself and said, I'd really like to interview you after this game. And he said, fine. By the time I got back and got back into what I was doing, he left, probably on purpose, but I'm not going to take it too personally. But then later in the football season, there was a game that Alabama was playing at home. This is when it was nothing big where you could hide down a big stadium. He was coming out off the field. And I had gathered up all my TV equipment, a 30-pound old film camera, and a tripod that was probably 20 pounds. It was still in my car, but I ran up to find him as he was coming off, and all the media was gathered around, and the highway patrol, which protects him. And I introduced myself, and I said, could I please do an interview? And he said, yes, because he probably recognized me. So I ran back to my car, which was 10 minutes away. And grabbed this equipment and dragged it back, which was not easy because I didn't weigh more than 115, and got there, and he was still there. He and the highway patrol were waiting for me. As I set up, they didn't offer to help. They weren't allowed. this camera and the tripod was tall, and I'm struggling, and I plug in the microphone and I run around and get in front of him and do this interview, and he was just delightful. He was a little annoyed because they lost, but he was unbelievably gracious considering the fact that he didn't have to do this.
Right. Oh, well, that's a good story, because I thought you were going to tell me he'd run off a second time.
I'll tell you why he didn't, Tommy. This time I told him that his son was dating one of my sorority sisters.
Ah, there you go. You had the trump card.
I did.
Very nice. So you were obviously covering sports on some level back then. Was that something that was part of your life or part of your interests from the beginning, or how did that all that happen?
Well, I was born in a very small town in northwest Alabama, Russellville. It's really in the middle of just pine trees and red clay. There's really not much going on except for the fact that the high school always had a winning team. This was a small town, maybe 3,800 people when I lived there, but they were football people. It was very much like Friday Night Lights. There was a lot of action going on around the football team. So even though I was young at the time, I just absorbed the nature of that. And I would go with my older siblings who were very into it, and it brushed off on me. So I realized that was the thing to do in your life, was to be a football fan. That's really where it started.
And then what made the transition for you from being a fan to actually covering games and being a journalist and that sort of thing?
Well, I couldn't get to that point without going through Jerome Martin, who I had a crush on in high school, and he was a lineman, an offensive lineman.
Uh-huh.
So just to get next to him, I would pull him aside and ask him questions about football. I knew some of them, but, you know, this was my excuse. So, and he really educated me about this, just because he loved having someone who adored him. I never dated him. He just wanted someone to adore him, and he explained football to me. And from that, by the time I got from high school to the University of Alabama, I got in a dorm that had the best view on the campus. It was right out the window was Bear Bryant's practice field. Standing up on one of those wooden things that they stand up on and look down on their kingdom. So I used to watch him a lot. He alone probably pushed it to the next level. But because I was in love with radio and television, just as a major, then that was kind of natural. Football was my first love. Well, Jerome, and then football, and then Alabama.
So anchor us in time here. About when is this you're talking about when you're making that decision in college?
You mean the years I was in college?
Yeah, like right around there, yeah.
No, the earth was just cooling. God was a child. No, I was there from...
Oh,
I got there just about the same time that Bear Bryant did.
Oh.
He was more successful than I was there, but we did arrive at about the same time, which was 58.
Okay. Yeah. And so at that time, when you said, I want to be in radio, TV, and I want to do sports, was that considered amongst, you know, the professors at Alabama a thing that you should be doing?
I don't know that any of those professors had a clue about sports. I got to pick my own assignment, so I chose sports. They didn't seem like sports fans, these professors. They seemed pretty wonderfully nerdy and nice to me, but they did not seem like sports fans. So I don't think they were the ones, but I got a job in Atlanta, and this was years later after I graduated, and I was actually married at the time, as a weather person. Then they called them weather girls. You know, it was that whole posture of that.
Sure.
But there was a young woman who had been hired to do some sports predictions. Her name was Jane Chastain. She was probably the first woman to do anything in sports. And she came on right after me when I was doing the weather, and she would always wear short shorts and a tight sweater and sit up on a stool and have a little cap on her head. And she did it fairly cutely, but she wasn't completely inept. She was pretty darn good at guessing these scores. But I noticed, I thought, well, now that's not how I'm not really interested in that presentation, but wow, she's gotten a chance to do this. The year that Jim Brown retired, played for the Cleveland Browns,
sure,
she gave this whole long story about his previous career, and she said, at the end, the Bears are really going to miss him. To which you could hear me gasping over in the side of her.
Because he played for the Browns.
And I knew that. And it sort of stuck in my brain at that point that that's really what I wanted to do. And the opportunity came later.
So how did that opportunity come?
Well, I was in Sarasota, Florida. My husband and I had moved there with our two children. I was since divorced. And there was a television station that was going on the air. It was a UHF. And for those people who are too young to know what that means, it meant it didn't have much coverage. And it was easy to get a license to do one of these. It went on the air, and I noticed it in the paper, and I called up the owner and introduced myself. And I said, I've got some experience in Atlanta doing the weather, and I'd like to work for your station. And he said, well, we've already hired a weather person. I said, great, because what I really want to do is sports. He said, well, that's interesting. He said, maybe you can come down sometime. We'll talk about it. I said, how about I come down soon and do an audition for you? Which he said, oh, okay. I did, but I didn't dare show up just as a person. I wrapped my leg up and got some crutches and told a story about tripping on the last point of a tennis match, you know, just so I'd have a little believability.
Wait a second. So you faked an injury?
Of course I did. Who hasn't? Who hasn't? And then I did an audition, and he was happy with it, and I got that job. So that's really how I started, was in Sarasota, Florida.
Well, there's a role model for all aspiring job
interviewers. Lie.
Wrap your knee up, come in on crutches. And were you anchoring the sports broadcast and then going out and doing stories as well?
Right. I was anchoring it. I was the sports director. I could make up shows and do anything I wanted, which I just loved. I appreciated that about the owner. He didn't care. He would just wanted to get some audience. I think our audience was probably 250 people or something. It wasn't very broad. But he was happy to let me do whatever I wanted to.
But even with that small audience, was there blowback from viewers or from people when you were trying to cover stories?
Not much. I think I was more of a curiosity than a threat. And that seemed to play okay. I was still in the South. Florida was very much like the South. Not exactly, but it was very much like the South. And there was not a lot of blowback. There was a lot of attention, but not a lot of blowback.
Yeah. And so I don't want to condense too much, but obviously you ended up at ABC. Mm-hmm. Were there several steps in between there?
I think the most important step between WXLT and ABC was during that time. ABC had started doing what's known as the superstars. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Sure, where the athletes would compete in sports that weren't their sport.
Exactly. Totally different sports. They were not allowed to compete in anything that was their expertise.
Right.
And this started probably in 71 or 72. I can't remember. But it was down the road from where my television station was. I watched the games on the air the year before, because this was a live-to-tape event. And I had watched and taken down the name of the executive producer and the coordinating producer. And I went out to where the games were. They loved to have people come out because they needed people in the stands. I found the ABC truck, and I knocked on the door. And a young man came to the door and said, may I help you? I said, yes, I'm looking for Chuck Howard. Okay, may I tell him who's asking? I said, tell him it's the first woman broadcaster who will ever be on ABC.
And who was Chuck Howard, by the way?
Chuck Howard was a coordinating producer for Superstars.
Okay.
And he was in that truck.
Right. And so I assume that he came out and you had a conversation?
We did. And he didn't laugh at all. The guy who answered the door did. But Chuck Howard came out, and he was very respectful and very nice, and he listened to me, and he said, let's walk over here because I've got to go over here to the tent and see some people. And so I explained why I needed to do this, and I was the right one. And he said, we don't really audition people on the air, and we don't train them on the air. He said, so go away, get some more experience, and let me know when that happens. Mm. So I shook his hand, left, and said, thank you very much. I went back to the station, called ABC, got his birth date from his secretary, Betts, and started sending birthday cards every year.
And how many years did it take to...
3 or 4, I can't remember. I was in Baltimore at the time when I got my first assignment from them, and I knew that that one and the ones that followed were auditions.
Man, I really could have used you at several points in my life when I was looking for jobs, just to figure out like how to get in the door. This has become like a job searching podcast here. That's amazing. So you get to ABC, and I know, just kind of describe some of the things you did while you were there.
My primary thing I started out with was Wide World of Sports, because they had so many different types of sports. There was water skiing and snow skiing and gymnastics at that time was on Wide World of Sports. And they would send me around the world to these events. they had a studio that would and it was Frank Gifford at the time, would introduce these things. So I did an awful lot of that. And then I did College Football Scoreboard with Dave Dials, which was, I loved that. I thought that was fabulous because it was intense and hard and, you know, on the spur of the moment. I loved it.
Intense and hard meaning like results were coming in as you were on the air.
And then they would say, we're going to throw you this highlight. And it includes, and they just verbally tell me what the highlight included and who was playing, and I had to remember it and then match it up as it rolled.
I think younger people don't remember how big and important those shows were at the time, because at most times there's only maybe one college football game every weekend. And so there wasn't like this constant rolling set of highlights that you have on SportsCenter or something now. Like you had to be there. If you were going to see, for example, the Georgia game that wasn't on TV, That's where you saw it.
That's right. You couldn't see them live. You had to be on that show, and I don't know of many other shows besides that one.
I always remember it always seemed to be Oklahoma and Nebraska every week on TV. I didn't care about either one of them, but I wanted to see the highlights of the games I did care about. Do you have any great stories about stuff happening while you're on air live or anything like that?
I wouldn't call it great. I'd call it tragic, and it still gives me nightmares. I was actually hosting College Football Scoreboard. I think it was about the last year I was on it. And Dave Dials would always leave early so he could catch the plane. Always. And I was left there, but it was not that big a deal. Usually there was like one break left that I had to cover, but he would always skedaddle out of there. And we were covering scores and some other action that was happening on the West Coast. We were supposed to throw to a West Coast game, which got us off the air.
Right.
And we threw to the West Coast game, and as soon as we got there, the producer explained, we've just lost all of the power in the stadium. We're coming back to the studio.
Oh, wow.
And I had to fill for, it was at least 25 minutes, the same scores over and over, and alone. And I'm telling you, I probably start out great. Not toward the end so much.
The kind of the fatigue sets in.
Oh my gosh, you've
done the LSU highlights.
And I felt like an idiot. I'm saying this again. It was pretty traumatic for me. I hated every second of it.
Now, Gentry had mentioned one thing to me when I was talking to him that maybe, I don't know at what point there, maybe at ABC, that you had taken some classes to maybe tamp down your accent a little bit or something like that.
Well, I think he thought I did.
Okay.
I think he thought I did. I had gone to Atlanta, and it was while I was still at that small station in Florida, and I wanted to get a bigger job because I thought I was ready to join ABC. And I was looking around several markets, and I went back to Atlanta, the very station where I was a weather person, and talked to the program director, who was not from there. I think he was from Chicago. And I explained to him I really would like to do sports at WAGA-TV. And he listened, you know, sort of with his nose in the air. And he said, you will never make it to the network with a Southern accent. So in my mind, that was the end of the interview. And I stood up and thanked him and shook his hand. Because from then on, I said, I am damn well going to get to where I want to go. Just because he said it.
I was going to say, did you ever feel like after that was any issue with anybody?
No, but I did start studying people who didn't have Southern accents, and I reduced it to a great degree. Northerners still thought I had a Southern accent. Southerners still thought I had a Northern accent. So somewhere in the middle.
Well, that is something that I always think about. You know, my mom and dad's, you know, generation, and then before that, everybody before that had a much deeper Southern accent than my generation does.
Right, exactly.
And I thought part of that leveling off has been through TV and broadcasting, that you sort of hear that sort of basic Midwestern accent and you start talking like what you're hearing. and that's why, did you remember, I'm sure there were people like, obviously like Keith Jackson doing play-by-play who had very strong Southern accents.
Right.
Was there anybody in sort of the studio level who sounded like you?
I don't recall because I wouldn't have thought they sounded like me.
Right.
I would have thought, you know, I'd straighten it all out and we all sound the same.
Right.
I didn't have anybody complain. The guy at the television station in Atlanta was the only one who had a problem with it.
Yeah.
Maybe they just didn't tell me, but it didn't stop ABC.
Yeah.
They thought it was fine.
Yeah. And so at some point I guess, have moved along from doing this kind of work to coaching. Mm-hmm. And what sort of triggered that, and how long had you been thinking about doing that? And
I hadn't thought about it until the event happened, and then I thought about it a lot. I was at a Big East tournament that was in New York. I was working in New York at the time. I was actually unemployed at the time. But I was doing some freelance work for a television station in New York, and they sent me to cover the Big East tournament. Patrick Ewing was playing for Georgetown at the time. And I don't know if you recall or our listeners recall, but John Thompson, the coach, did not allow any of his players to do interviews. Right. He thought it was a distraction. It took away from basketball, and he was not going to have it. None of his players understood how to handle the media. And Patrick Ewing, being shy and not understanding how to handle the media, made it even worse. I didn't expect him to do an interview when I went to cover that game because of John Thompson's policy. But when we got there, for some reason, Thompson said, okay, we're going to let you have Patrick. And I'm standing there with probably 25 other media people. I may have been the only television person there. And when the other writers finished asking their questions, while they were doing that, I noticed how really uncomfortable he is. He was sweating bullets, and it was just a media interview. Most of them left when I got mine. I said, I'm sorry, Patrick, but I'm going to need to ask you some of these questions again because it's television and I have to ask it on camera. And he really was so discomforted that I noticed it, and I went ahead and asked what I did, and couldn't give me much. It was mostly yes and no. But while that was happening, I thought, I can help people do this job better so it pays off for them. So they feel better about it, and it helps their careers. So Patrick Ewing, I give all the credit for that.
When we come back, Andrea Kirby tells how she ended up becoming the answer to a Trivial Pursuit question. That and more coming up on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
What kind of big clients did you, what was your first client where you felt like, okay, I can really make this work as a way to make a living?
The New York Mets. And the reason for the New York Mets is, and I have to back up a little bit, everybody who ran the New York Mets, in my mind, was formerly in Baltimore, where I was, and they knew me. In my mind, Baltimore is Southern. It's as good for me as being in Alabama.
That's one of the quintessential questions, yes. Is Maryland the South?
Well, I think it's the South, and you're not changing my mind. That's my story, and I'm sticking with it. So all of those Baltimore Oriole people had moved to New York to manage the Mets, and they knew me. So when I presented this to one man, Al Harrison, who was the general manager at the time, I explained to him about Patrick Ewing and why it would help their players, and he said yes. So he was the first. The New York Mets were the first.
And that became, I believe, the reason that you are a question in the Trivial Pursuit game.
That's exactly correct.
There's a question in one of the editions of Trivial Pursuit. What baseball team's troubled players were taught a course in the art of dealing with the media by Andrea Kirby in 1986. And so if you're ever in Trivial Pursuit and you didn't know that one, that's the Mets, right? Because they had some kind of crazy players, right? Yeah. Lenny Dykstra and Daryl Strawberry, Dwight Gooden. There were some really big personalities on that team, right? So what did you do with them?
Oh, gosh, how do I explain this? I think, first of all, I had to be a very good listener. I had to know that within 30 seconds, if I didn't have their attention, I never would. I was a woman. They were going to notice that immediately and think I had nothing to teach them. So I made it very concise, very entertaining. I collected video of all the how-not-tos and compiled some together. At that point, I think it was Bobby Bonilla who had a blow-up in the clubhouse, and it turned out to be a big deal. And players weren't doing that then. This was one of the first.
Right.
So I started off the workshop with that. And then asking, you know, what happened to get him to this point where that was his only way out? And it starts the discussion. So there was a lot of interaction I would explain to them in visual ways why it's good for your career, and that you don't want to answer something you don't have to. Here's how not to. So it was a long developing project that I put together, starting out with the players who taught me a lot of it.
And did you have pretty good buy-in from those players? I mean, did some say, oh, absolutely, and others say, forget it?
The only person who did not, this was a three-day program. Can you imagine having athletes in your audience for 3 days?
Yeah.
It was three half days. It was in spring training, and it was after their morning workouts. And the only person who didn't return on day two was Doc Gooden. And according to the BR person, his dad had told him he didn't want him to. Everybody else was golden.
So that was spring training of 86?
85.
So, and they won the World Series the next year?
Yes.
So I'm sure you're taking partial
credit. Of course.
I have to say that when I think of media training, the first thing I think of is that scene in Bull Durham where they're on the bus and Crash Davis is telling Nuke, here are your cliches. Get to know them. You know, we gave 110%. I'm just doing it for the team, that sort of thing. And as a media person, you know, that sort of thing drives me crazy. And so what are you telling them that's different than what I'm thinking?
So different.
Okay.
I'm so glad. They don't understand what a wonderful story they are and how interesting it is to us to know what it's like to be them. So I had to point this out, and they had to learn how to tell their story. When someone asks what happened on that play, and a player's thinking, well, you saw it, what's the problem with you? It's not the information. It's coming from you. What was it like to be you? We practiced their stories a lot. They had to be convinced that they could tell a story, a game story, without giving away the store, without opening it up to things they didn't want to talk about.
You mean like secrets on how they do plays or something?
Or their personal life.
Okay.
That's off base. But once they learn how to tell the story to you, you've got something to write. Because if you don't have something to write, you're likely to make something up.
Well, I don't know about
that. Maybe not you.
Maybe not me personally. I got to come up with something. I'll put it that way. Now, as we're talking, we're in the middle of the Olympics. And so have you worked with Olympians in the past?
Yes. I had that 1996 Atlanta Olympics.
Okay.
I was the official media coach for them. And I got to work with most of the teams. It was the gymnastics who said no.
Oh, really?
That looks a little cloistered if you look back on it anyway. But most of the teams within, and it was a lot of travel, and it was absolutely fabulous, and they were all so different. The primary difference in them was they went for 4 years without anybody asking them anything.
Right.
Now suddenly they're in the heat of it, and here it all comes. So this was fabulous for them.
That's what I was thinking, that there's many of those sports, not all of them, but many of them, are very sort of underground
Right. Until
the Olympics, and then they're the biggest thing in the world for
Right. 2 weeks
or whatever.
Right.
So what do you remember a couple of stories about particular athletes you worked with you thought, you know, you helped them a lot, or stories that you remember from that time?
I remember that the swimmers, I can't remember how many there were, but there were men and women. And they were fabulous at telling the story. And one of the stories I insist that they think of is what was going on inside your head. Every single one of them did it. Mm-hmm. And they did it with some eye contact that made you think they were talking to you. They were probably the best of all of them, the men and the women. I'm trying to think of Amy's, this girl's last name. She was 14 years old. She did a fabulous job.
Uh-huh.
And so did Jim Rouse, this young swimmer. But they had learned how to describe, you know, when I was on the turn, I'm thinking this, and I'm looking up in the crowd and blah. And suddenly you just want to hear from this kid. And they were the best.
I wonder if swimming or something like that gives you time to think in a way that
Yeah. Maybe
like weightlifting doesn't.
Right.
I don't know if there's some sports where you're in your head more than
Right. Others.
And maybe part of the job is kind of getting you out of there.
Yeah, getting you
out
of there.
And not thinking about that stuff so much.
But if you think of what their whole life is about, too, and it's not just the Olympians, it's all of the athletes, they're made to focus on hitting the ball, catching the ball, swimming, moving your arms perfectly. They're not given any reason to think of anything else. And then suddenly they've got to think of what it's like to be them and tell a story. And it's just, it's unnatural.
I wonder what you've thought, you know, just in the last few days, as we've been talking, you know, LeBron James has sort of been, was pretty outspoken about his thoughts about the president and gun control and that sort of thing. And then Fox News commentator Lauren Ingraham basically said, these guys should just shut up and dribble. And then LeBron has kind of come back, and there's been some back and forth there. I guess as somebody who kind of coaches athletes to talk about these things, you know, I guess I have two questions about that. First of all, do you think it's okay for athletes to speak out about politics or their personal lives or whatever, whatever's on their mind? You know, would you advise doing that? And secondly, are there certain ways that you would advise them to do it and not do it?
This is going to cost you a lot.
Okay. I have like $17 in my billfold at the moment. But
every client is so different, and it depends on their capacity to be able to speak out in a way that they want to, because there will be repercussions, and some can and some can't. And some I will recommend it and some I will not. That's been true with everybody I've ever coached. When I'm with them, I want to hear from them and see what it's like based on what they've been through, what they think they can handle, what they can't. When it comes to, I'll back up to the NFL players, if I may, just because to me that's fresher in my mind. I followed it more closely than LeBron's situation. But the fact that people hold bright and shiny things and say, no, it's about this, when it's not, to that NFL player, it's about discrimination. That's what it's like to him. And just because someone says, no, it's about something else, well, maybe that's what it's about to them. But there would be a long discussion and back and forth with an athlete to decide, you know, this is what you'll probably get. This is the kind of pushback you'll get. How do you feel about that? And what are you going to do about it if that happens? And because it's so individual, when we go through that, they will understand exactly whether or not they want to take that on or not, and what the consequences are.
Now, I don't know that you may know this. Did you get the sense from hearing, like, Colin Kaepernick, for example, that he had been coached when he did all this, or did it feel like it just kind of came off of that?
I couldn't tell. He wasn't slick, I was happy to say, because that's really not – that's always obvious when someone has been coached to be very slick and get everything perfectly. I didn't think he had been, but I only saw, like, one example of it. So I don't think he had.
What are more sort of common problems that kind of across the board with athletes? Is it that just idea of not knowing how to tell their own stories? Are there like speech problems sometimes or that sort of thing?
Well, I would say the second biggest problem, besides not understanding what your story is and how to tell it, which will avoid other things showing up printed and broadcast, is that so many of the athletes think that writers and broadcasters are out to get them, that they only care about things that are controversial. It's not true. You want a story. If it's a good story, you don't care which one it is, but you have to have a story. And then at the end of the workshops, I bring in writers, I pay them, to do an exercise of a mock news conference. So the players can practice these things, and also the media feels bought into this process. It's very good for the relationship when we do this. And by then, the players understand things can be handled and that they are responsible for what comes out of the mouth. But misunderstanding the media's whole purpose of doing this is the primary thing.
Do you feel like there are instances where the media is unfair or biased in some way? And if that's the case, how do those biases usually sort of manifest themselves?
I think the media, often when they misbehave, I'm going to use it that way. If I think they're being unfair or they're taking a tact that really is not for the good of anybody, is because they've been mistreated, they think. If there's whole misunderstanding between athletes and writers. And when you clear that up, often you clear up a lot of it. But there are still some people who just don't appreciate what it's like to be an athlete, and the athlete doesn't appreciate what it's like to be a writer. I would always tell an athlete, here's what you need to do to be fair and to protect yourself. And if they go against that and they take advantage of that, then it's not like you're going to stop talking to them, but they'll never get anything good ever again.
I know you also have worked with athletes who've become broadcasters, right?
Yes.
In fact, I found a story somewhere. I was Googling a story on Phil Sims, mm-hmm. Who was an NFL player for a long time and obviously went on to be an NFL broadcaster for CBS for a while. In the story, Phil Sims said, "You're Bill Parcells with makeup on." Bill Parcells being a notoriously tough coach. And then I think the story called you, I'm quoting here, a renowned athlete whisperer known for polishing jocks into talking heads.
Yes.
Yeah. And so when you're working with someone who was on the field and now is up in the broadcast booth or whatever, what are the challenges there?
It's very personal to them, again, because they were not taught this before, and now suddenly their whole career is this. It's broadcasting. Yeah. It's very new to them. They're much more open than athletes who are still on the field.
Right.
Now they know if they're going to have another career, they need to get some advice that will help them be good at it. I find that quarterbacks are the quickest studies. They're used to studying these playbooks, and they've got it in one or two sessions,
right.
And then they go out and they use it, whatever it is they've learned. And Phil Sims was that way. But there were a number of other quarterbacks like that. And then there are people who, I know this sounds strange, but there was an outfielder that I was coaching. He was the first broadcast person I was a coach for, Gary Maddox with the Phillies. Mm-hmm. And outfielders, I guess, get real quiet, you know, and they don't have much to say.
A lot of space between players, yeah.
A lot of space. And he had to be taught to speak up, to come in with something to say and say it with being concise and with authority. So, but they're all a little different. Some of them are just downright not sure they're able to do it, and some of them can't.
Are there people you see now that maybe you've worked with at one point who you can see, wow, they've come so far, you know, like maybe you worked with them, they were an athlete, and now they're a broadcaster or something, like what a leap they've made.
Right. Well, I think Phil Sims was one of those. And Gary Danielson, he's another quarterback. You know,
sure.
They pick up on
it. Does all
quickly.
The SEC games now.
Yeah,
for,
and I think he's terrific. And Lee Corso was one of them. He was so excited to have help because he did not want to fail on the job. And he was really easy to work with.
Well, it's so funny because Lee Corso, you know, for those of you who don't know, is sort of the kind of one of the big voices of College Game Day on ESPN. But he's also, the sense I get from him is that he's obviously been doing professional broadcasting for a while, but his charm is that he comes off as just like this guy who kind of wandered onto the set, you know, and just says whatever's in his head. I mean, is that sort of his natural personality?
It is. It absolutely is. And I'm not out to change their personalities. I want them to take a look at the game they're calling and figure out a way to make it sound like it's just you and another guy or you and another woman over a beer talking about the game.
Right.
They all have different ways of doing it because of their personalities, and they come along sort of at different paces. But Lee Corso got that right off the bat.
There's one other athlete I wanted to ask you about, Jerry Stackhouse, who played basketball in North Carolina, was in the NBA for a long, long time. There was a story where he mentioned that you had asked him to write down a list of his best qualities mm-hmm. before going into interviews.
Right.
And so I wonder if that's a tactic that you used a lot and sort of what you were trying to get at there.
I think I'm a frustrated psychologist. I've been shrunk myself. I used to be 5'6". I'm really 5'5" now. I think there are a number of different ways to get people who don't know you. It's total strangers have been put in your care to get them to relax. And I think understanding yourself is really, really important. I still use that. I've used it with my kids. I've used it with my son, whom you know. I think it's important for people to understand what their qualities are. When we're little kids, our parents will often tell us how cute we are, how talented we are. And my parents told me I was the greatest kid in the world. I believed that until some people begged to differ. But I think we go too long as an adult life with nobody telling us what our qualities are. So it's just part of what they need to know to do the job well.
Although it's interesting, too, because I think many professional athletes have been told since the time they were small children how great they are at their sport.
Right.
And so is it just a matter of like they compartmentalize it and said, I'm great at this, but I'm terrible at this other thing?
Right. And I'm not even sure they were told they were great. They were told they had to do it. You know, there was some pressure that didn't necessarily have love in it.
Right.
So it's just a way for them to look at themselves that I consider absolutely important.
One of the people that you work with was Jim Mora, NFL coach, Saints and Colts, I think, at the time. And he's sort of known for a kind of a famous soundbite, and that sort of played into your work, right?
Yeah, it did. I got called just because of the playoffs thing. I've often gotten business because of outbursts like this, which they just could not afford to continue. And he looks on camera when he's having one of these outbursts like he would just eat you and your firstborn alive.
Right.
But when we were together with the Saints, he invited, and I suggested, and he invited everybody on the coaching staff to be there when we were coaching him. it became an entire staff coaching. When we were there, he was absolutely fabulous. There was nothing aggressive about him at all. I got to show all of his tapes, where he'd offended everybody in the media. And he just, kind of give it a little yip.
I was going to say, so was he embarrassed to see that, or was he just sort of,
He didn't act like it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't have had the success in that room if he hadn't come in there with that right attitude.
Right.
But it was a very successful group.
You also, I think, mentioned Kerry Collins, somebody you worked with. Kerry played at Penn State, played for the Carolina Panthers, and had a pretty long NFL career as well.
Right, he did. I did not notice anything about Kerry when he was with the Carolina Panthers, but I had to go back and kind of look at what happened when he had to leave here. And my understanding was he was in a bar and made some comments that were racist. And
that's right. That was a huge story in Charlotte.
Huge story in Charlotte. And I found out about him from the New Orleans Saints after he'd been traded there. And Bill Koharik, who was the general manager I had known from working with Jim Mora, and he called me up and said, you know, Kerry's not going to do well here if we don't straighten this out, so would you work with him, which I did. And so when he got to the Saints, I introduced him to this other tool that I use. It's a personality tool, and it sort of explains to you why you behave the way you do. And his personality is one that's very internal and very private, and he's in his head a lot. So when the Panthers had, I guess it was a coach, somebody insisted that he act more like a leader, that's where he was behaving outside a personality that he knew anything about. He was trying to be, by leader meant you drink more and you say outrageous things, and it didn't work for him. So I explained this whole personality thing to Kerry, and when I showed him the description of this thoughtful, head-oriented type, who's very good with detail and not an outward leader, there was a big sigh of relief. Now, that number in the personality system is a 5. There are 9 different types. It's the Enneagram, and I teach it with a lot of my clients. And he was so relieved, and he was so easy to work with from that point. Now, I never saw him again because I don't think he even lasted the rest of the season with New Orleans before he was traded to Tennessee.
Yeah.
But I looked up his jersey in Tennessee, and it was 5. He had selected a 5.
Oh, that's great.
So I didn't talk to him again, but I assumed it stuck.
Well, I hope so, yeah. And that leads me to ask that if part of what you do sort of crisis management with athletes, like if they've done something like that, or they've, you know, something really bad has happened and they're trying to figure out how to talk about it or not talk about it or whatever, are you kind of brought in to deal with it?
Yes. There's a lot of crisis management. It's not my favorite work, but it's what they really need on the moment. And a lot of it is done one-on-one, which I also think is not as good for people and athletes as the group dynamic, because especially if you're a team, because then you get support from your other people. And I've had a number of people. John Daly was a crisis management one.
A continuing, I think, yeah.
He was very kind and very nice and really looked like he was lost.
Yeah.
But he was a nice guy. He behaved himself well. I did get a call to work with Mike Tyson, and I simply said no.
Yeah. And why was that? You feel like that was sort of beyond the pale? Or?
I could tell from watching him, he was not interested in anybody telling him what to do.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel right. That's the only person I've ever turned down.
Huh.
was Mike Tyson. But there were a number of coaches who ran into this issue, and it always worked out great because they knew they needed to change the way they handled this part of their career. You can't avoid it, so you might as well win at it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel like, in general, athletes are able to deal with the pressure of, say, moving to broadcasting, or is it like they never, you know, because I think of athletes as being really well-equipped to deal with pressure in their sport. Does the pressure of moving to something like this, are they sort of starting all over, or can they draw on some of those things they learned while they were playing?
I think it's so different that they can't. No, it is so different. They're now asked, instead of using their body and everything they've ever learned, they're asked to sit down and be still and then get in at a certain time. It's so different. I almost think they can't draw on that. But they can learn from it because they're learners.
Yeah.
They know how, and they're survivors. And if they really want to do this, they will learn how to do it. And some don't.
I want to circle back around two things. First of all, I guess I'll go, you know, to the less savory side, and then I'll try to end on a higher note. As you've seen the sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, Me Too movement over the last, you know, 6 months to a year, and all these people, men who are in positions of power being sort of booted out or shamed or whatever for sexual harassment, sexual assault in some cases, all these patterns. I'm wondering if any of those things sound familiar to you or to women you knew who were trying to do the same work you were doing at the time.
I used to say I didn't experience any of that. And recently people, before Me Too, people would ask me if that happened. And I said, no, that never happened to me. I'm writing a book now and I'm uncovering things. And then I realize, of course it did. I just waved it off. I took a different tack to it because it felt important for my survival. I couldn't get distracted. I had two kids to feed and educate, and I couldn't get distracted. And I don't think I ever knowingly thought that I'm going to wave this off.
Right.
I noticed it. It happened. It was disappointing, but it couldn't stop me because I couldn't allow that. So, yes, I resonate with it throughout my career. And at that point, no one, when I was on the air, no one would have spoken up about this.
And that's the thing. It felt like that was, you know, from my understanding, almost like just a part of daily life in
right.
some of those newsrooms and some of those other places back then. And that even if people had wanted to talk about it, there's who would you talk to, right?
Right. It didn't necessarily feel wrong. It
yeah.
just was.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I want to end on is now, and you know, you had started back when you started now in 2018, you know, every broadcast network, every sports network has many women in prominent roles in many places. I wonder how that feels to you, you know, how satisfying that feels, and what you think still needs to happen.
I think obviously it feels fabulous. I'm almost happy I was in on the beginning because it was so original. Everything felt original. Everything felt fresh. Everything I did was one of a kind. So I didn't mind the failures and the wave-offs and all the things that happened in retrospect because what I did get to do was just fabulous. It was a fabulous part of my life, and I wouldn't have had that same experience. So I'm thrilled that it is the way it is now. I think the only way it will change is slowly. I think some of the conversations that are being designed to happen in a way that will change how men think about it as well as how women think about it, that's a big deal. Women can't do this by themselves. The men have to jump on board and say absolutely. But it will be slow. It will probably still be painful because there will be times when accusations are wrong. It's just bound to happen. So I'm looking forward to the time when it is understood that we are equal in many ways. We're never going to be the same, thank goodness, but we will be equal, and it will take a while.
So, Andrea, you know, looking back at all this, do you kind of consider yourself a pioneer, a trailblazer in sort of women's broadcasting, especially in the sports field?
I do. I didn't think of it at the time that I started it or wanted to start it. I just knew it was something that I wanted to do. I had loved sports my whole life. I had been a sports fan, and I'd grown up in colleges and high schools that were good at football. So it was just something that was in my nature. I was a Tom girl, so this was right up my alley. So I didn't stop to think, I'm a pioneer. I realized it the first time somebody wrote an article using that word. But I also don't particularly care for competition. I'd rather be original.
Andrea, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for talking
to us. My pleasure.
All right. Andrea Kirby didn't mind calling herself a trailblazer, but only when we asked her about it. It's hard to be the first one to do anything. Sports broadcasting, like most other media, used to be the province of middle-aged white men. That has changed a lot, and for the better, thanks to Andrea Kirby and the others like her who just wanted to do what they loved. And she didn't have to give up her accent to do it. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. The producer of this episode was Greg Colley. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or if you have a firm opinion on whether Nick Saban has surpassed Bear Bryant, email me at tomlinsonwrites@gmail.com. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on WFAE.org, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com.